Big Brother actually is watching you and your every move. In other words, your privacy rights are being trampled on and they are being violated by governments and big tech companies. Both are egregious abuses of power. Now, you may wish to shrug it off and say to yourself, I have nothing to worry about. I live a clean life. Then one day, says former NSA veteran William Binney, you become irritated by an act of overreach by your government. So you decide to exercise your right to freedom of speech and thought and your right to peacefully protest. So you stand in front of City Hall and call out what you believe to be an injustice. Binney says when you do that, you will be put on a watch list. They will find you, and quickly. That's because you and your data left electronic fingerprints everywhere. And contrary to what you may believe about democratic governments not spying on its citizens, they are. And he goes on to say they will use the information they gather about you against you. William Binney is a 36-year veteran of the National Security Agency in the United States, and he says what the government is doing is unconstitutional. Binney was granted a special recognition by the Allard Prize for International Integrity for blowing the whistle on the NSA for using a program he developed called Thin Thread because they were spying on Americans. I invited William Binney to join me for a conversation that matters about your loss of privacy both in Canada and the United States.
Well, thanks for having me.
You left the NSA shortly after the raids on 9/11 because you believed that there was an abuse of power. Back then, you said that the rights of Americans were being, trampled on, misappropriated, that they were not being respected. How bad was it then, and how bad has it become?
Back then, the initial step they took was to take in all of the billing records of phone calls on U.S. citizens. That was we Americans were the first ones in the bulk acquisition of data program because we were the closest. So they, and also at that time, I think about 80% of the international traffic crossing the fiber optic lines passed through the United States. So if they did it here, they would get 80% of what happened in the world. And so that was their objective. Now, some people may think that might be difficult, but with today's capacity for processing and storing, this is almost a trivial issue. It's easy to do. As the tech companies are showing you, they're doing it. So, I mean, it's not that difficult to do. But that started with that. And then in early 2002, they spread and put more equipment out there to collect content. And Mark Klein exposed some of this in the 2002 period, where they were putting NARIS devices in the AT&T facility in San Francisco, and he put this in the court record, diagrams and all of that, and the equipment nomenclature and everything. And what that says was they were taking down virtually everything on the lines, everything on the fiber lines. And that was the vast majority of the communications of U.S. citizens, as well as a good portion of everybody else in the world. And then after that, it simply expanded not just to phone calls, but to emails, and then to collecting content of emails, storing all of this information, and then storing chatter and storing short messaging, and then going into banking and travel. They already had travel. And then doing all kinds of financial things with credit cards and bank checks and things of that nature.
Had they not initially encrypted that information about American citizens and locked it away so that in essence they were protecting the rights of American citizens?
That was what I had instituted under the Thin Thread program. When they started this program violating the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, as well as any number of other laws. And I called them on it, by the way, and I've been trying to get them into court to address that, and I haven't been able to do that. The courts won't let it in. So, the whole thing was, it started with that, and that was from there, it just went downhill. And I started calling this because I was been working the Soviet problem for 27 years. And I said, this is the first step towards totalitarianism. This is what the The Nazis did. This is what the communists in China did. This is what the communists in the Soviet Union did. This is standard totalitarian procedures. First, you get control and find out what the population is doing, and then you subvert them, and you use all of that information and power against them. And that's the path we take. And we just kept sliding down this path. I've tried to get them into court with affidavits to different court cases for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, and independent lawyers suing them, as well as put in affidavits in the Roger Stone case and the General Flynn case. And I've tried to send messages in to President Trump when he was there, and Attorney General Barr, and all kinds of people who are leading investigations for the supposed investigations for the FBI and the DOJ. And none of them are taking this on. None of them.
Was the tipping point 9/11? Is that when the mindset changed to say, well, we need to protect American citizens, and then that became the veil behind which this shift took place?
There's a little bit of inside the information I got on this. It came from this CEO of Quest, who was approached in February of 2001, just 7 months before 9/11. And he was approached by people from NSA asking him to turn over all of his information on all of his customers, Americans as well, to NSA. And he said he couldn't do that legally. If they'd get a warrant, why, he would do that. But that showed intent before 9/11. But what they did when 9/11 happened, they used 9/11 as a lever to instigate and institute the violations of law and the Constitution against the people of the United States and basically the people of the world. What they did was they changed the policy of how we looked at communications and analyzed things from groups of people, terrorist groups, drug smuggling groups, militaries, governments, things of that nature, to individuals. So that meant they switched from going after simply the bad guys, if you will, or potentially bad guys, to everybody. And that started I first ran across that and knew about them doing that in the second week of October of 2001. And it took me 2 weeks then to get out of the place because I could not be a party to that total violation of the rights of U.S. citizens and basically everybody in the world.
So the NSA had authority, of course, to monitor communication for people who were non-American nationals. But then they switched to then sharing that information, as I understand it, internally and looking at the activities of Americans. Is that the way that progressed?
Yes, and Mueller, when he was director of FBI, just about to leave that office in March of 2011, he gave an interview to Bart Gellman, and he told him at that point that the FBI had been using the Stellar Wind program. That's the domestic spying program. See, they compartmentalize these things. Anything dealing with U.S. citizens collected in bulk acquisition is put into the Stellar Wind program. Okay, and he said they've been using that to go after crime since 2001. So wow. What that means is, and this was published by Reuters in August of 2013, I believe, that means is that FBI was looking into all the collection that NSA did on everybody, everything that everybody did electronically, and then scanning it for potential violations or criminal intent. And at that point, they would use that to go and arrest people. And so once they did that, you see the NSA data wasn't admissible in a court of law, so they had to do what they called a parallel construction. Means they would send police out to do a standard policing techniques and gather the data that would show the criminal acts that they already knew about in from the NSA data. And they would acquire it through that police action and then substitute that for the NSA data in a court of law. Now, that I called perjury. You know, that's just outright perjury, fabricating evidence for a court of law. And in the instructions to the police who were told about this to go do this, they were never allowed to say anything about the source of the data, put it in any affidavits, tell the judge or any of the lawyers in the court defending or prosecuting. They weren't allowed to do any of that. And they couldn't put it in any written form to the court at all. They were simply to present the parallel constructed data. So that meant they denied due process to all the defendants because they could not challenge the original information that was used against them to get arrested. That's their right to challenge that. That denied them that right. That's a violation of the Sixth Amendment. And they violated the Fifth Amendment by using that data against them. And that's like using your conversations or your statements against you. And they did that without a warrant. So that's a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And then they violated the First Amendment by denying everybody free association, because you're not free to associate, because anything you do is now recorded and all your associates are gathered together and linked to you. So through phone calls, emails, money transactions, travel, what have you.
Mapping.
So it's a violation of the First Amendment. Not counting, by the way, the Pen Register Law, Electronic Privacy Act, Electronic Security Act, and all the laws covering the FCC regulations governing telecommunication companies. It just scrapped the entire legal system of the United States. And then we spread it around the world. And so now the Canadians are in it, the Five Eyes are in it, and about at least 9 other countries.
So how does the Five Eyes, and a number of people won't know what the Five Eyes are, but this inter-agency, inter-country network, how do they work together to circumvent domestic laws, but supply one another with information about each other's citizens?
Well, that goes back to who looks at the data. NSA collects all the data. So there's no differentiation between British citizens, Canadian citizens, US citizens, or Russians, or what have you. We're all the same, and all the data is captured and stored. Now, the Five Eyes have a special access program. That's the US, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and United States. And I mean, UK. So the 5 English-speaking countries in the world. They have a special arrangement where they use a program called IC Reach to interrogate that database. So they can go in and analyze things from one can do, the British can analyze things in the US, the US they can analyze people in England, and vice versa, you know. So it's just a relationship that they could offload some of the work to others if they didn't want to do it for whatever reason. But it didn't make any difference. You see, the FBI could do it all. So they could still do it too. So, and their MI5 can do it. I mean, it's the same.
So what chance do we have as average people to protect our privacy, our right to free speech and free thought, leading to, as in my introduction, I had also the right to peacefully demonstrate against something that we see as an injustice. Are we helpless here?
For example, I've tried the courts, to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court of the United States has rejected any hearing of any of this violation of constitutional and human rights inside the U.S. alone. So they rejected that. They didn't want to hear it. So I've ruled the courts out. Certainly the Department of Justice is out, because I've sent any number of things to them. I even met with their Inspector General's people, and they haven't done anything except promote and basically protect this massive bulk acquisition program. I mean, it is the crown jewel of all this intelligence agency, because it's a collection of everything that's content of everything that's collected or transmitted in the world by everybody, all the members of parliaments, every parliament in the world, all the government members, anything that's transmitted and can be captured is, and they've got it. And that's real power. Now, what that means is that's what I, in a talk I gave at the Oxford University, I said, when you give this kind of power to people, eventually they use it against you. Well, that's what the Democrats did with the IRS against conservative groups. That's what's happening now in Canada. I'm sure they're mining the people who are organizing the trucker actions, and they're going to go after them as the central conspirators of this terrorist group or whatever they want to call it. They'll make it up.
What I find interesting about your career and your history is you initially started raising these concerns when you were still with the NSA, saying, look, we are breaching you know, the boundaries of our authority, and yet nobody wanted to listen to you. And you did the honorable thing. You resigned.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't stay there. But I didn't do that in an inside NSA because I knew they were, it was a lost cause, because I knew these people. I knew Hayden and all his cronies underneath him. I knew what they were and how they operated. So they had backing from somebody other than outside the agency to be able to do this. I knew that. So I went to the Congress, the intelligence committees, to address that, because that was their job under the stemming from the Church Committee investigations of NSA, CIA, and FBI back in the 1970s, when Nixon used them against the U.S. people back then. And so I went directly to the staffer on the House Intelligence Committee that I knew, and I told her all about this violation of rights and the things that they were doing, because I designed half of this program that they're using to do it, and I knew how all of it worked together. And I was the one putting together how you can manage handling large and vast amounts of data. So it was my responsibility to stand up against it.
You know, there is this belief that if you shine light on wrongdoing, that the brightness of that light will bring it to a conclusion. That's not the case here. You brought this up, you've made a point, you've tried to take it to the Supreme Court of the United States, and still those in charge and who have this power go, we're not going to stop. So what do we do?
So that leads me to the only thing I could think of to do, and that's to hire people into government, starting at whatever level you can, fire anybody who is supporting these programs or continues to vote for them, watch the voting and get rid of people who do this, and then look retroactively, go back and make sure you go and indict these people who have done this over time. And you make sure that you get them all and hold them all accountable. It's the only way to stop it. Because if you don't hold these people accountable, they will do it again.
Didn't President Obama promise that that's what he was going to do when he took office? And then he went in the other direction.
Yeah, he went big time in the other direction. He doubled down on the entire program because he realized the power it gave him. That's the real issue. I mean, money, power, and control have been the driving forces of every totalitarian, every despot in the world.
So that's governments, but big tech companies also have access to much of this same information. And so we as average citizens need to be very aware of our communication and how it is going to be gathered and used. Do you have any suggestions on what the average person can do to protect themselves? Or is it a lost cause?
The average person, I don't think, can do very much at all, unless they collectively get together and force governments to start passing something like the European Union did, the CDPR regulations, where it said any of the data that a person is that person's data. And so if you want to do anything, sell it, use it for advertising, do anything, you have to get the permission of that person to do that. Now, that would shut down a lot of stuff, you know?
So what I find interesting is you have carried out a fairly lengthy campaign to shine light on this, to take action, to raise awareness, and yet in my dealings and telling people that this is a program that's underway and that we are all being watched, there seems to be a considerable amount of apathy about the fact that this is happening to us. And I don't quite understand why average people aren't up in arms about the fact that there is this surveillance of them and everything they do.
Yeah, I think it's because they've been fed the lie that we need to do this to protect you. If we can't do this, we won't be able to protect you. And that's an outright lie. And they knew that back in the 1990s because we had already proven how to do it and how to do it successfully with the Thin Thread program. That is using a disciplined policing discipline approach to finding criminals, using probable cause and things that reflect probable cause in communications. And that's how you separate things out. That's how we were able to manage being able to look into massive amounts of data and find bad things without having to look at that data itself. It's how you can look into data without looking at it. If you look at it, you're buried. There's just too much of it. But if you can look into it and pull out relevant stuff without having to look at it, you succeed.
So are we naive to believe that because we live in a so-called democratic country, that we have rights and, you know, we expect these things to happen in totalitarian regimes, but it could never happen here. Are we just being naive, burying our head in the sand because life's pretty good?
Yes, we are. I mean, people are not. I mean, I've said democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to get active or you're going to lose it. And that's basically what's happening. We're losing our rights and human rights here as time progresses. They're just conditioning us to accept them over time, lesser and lesser degrees.
So what, in essence, what we've done then is hand power to people to say, to tell us how we're supposed to live our lives and what we are and are not allowed to do, which is the antithesis of the whole concept of democratic societies, that you have freedom of choice.
Yeah, it's 1984 on steroids.
Yeah, in a way that we never could have imagined.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Where do you go from here?
I'm still frustrated with
the Supreme Court of the United States. Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm going to start back at the federal level and start trying to do injunctions and things like that at the federal level and just try to get back into it that way. And slowly but surely, maybe I can get somebody in Congress to listen. But, you know, even when I went down there, I said, you guys, as long as you vote, I mean, I went to several staff offices there, staffers in the senior staffers on the Senate and House side. And I said, if you guys keep voting for this crap, You're accessories to this conspiracy to destroy the Constitution of the United States, you know. And I didn't get any real reaction. I'm sorry to talk, I really didn't.
Well,
and it's really amazing to me. It's their oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution. Everybody does that. That's their oath of office, not to a person or a party or anything. It's the Constitution, you know. And that's the fundamental Bill of Rights of humanity.
Well, I appreciate your ongoing efforts to shine light on this and to address it. And I encourage you to keep going because I think that it's vitally important. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Today, the mass surveillance of all Americans by the U.S. government and its corporate partners is a totally normalized reality. Despite its widespread acceptance, it is an outrageous, blatant violation of our constitutional rights. It's difficult to ascertain how the chilling effect of dragnet spying has changed society in the post-9/11 world. However, many insiders in the intelligence community understood the dangers of these programs from the beginning. Edward Snowden is celebrated as a hero for bringing proof of NSA's mass spying and bulk collection to the world. But years prior, Bill Binney had blown the whistle on this very same program. A 36-year veteran at the NSA, Bill Binney was the technical director, responsible for developing and overseeing the agency's spying technology. He even developed ThinThread, the data monitoring program that was later hijacked by the Bush administration to implement widespread warrantless surveillance. Mounting pressure caused Obama to pass the Freedom Act in 2015, which only outsourced its bulk acquisition to telecom companies, using the secretive FISA court as an intermediary. And nearly 20 years after 9/11, these unaccountable agencies are using new fears, like of Russian cyber warfare, to grow their power and operations. I caught up with Binney in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia, where he received the Allard Prize for International Integrity, to talk to him about blowing the whistle and the fight against the surveillance state today. So you were the technical director at the NSA for many, many years. Talk about what you were trying to do with the creation of ThinThread.
It was basically to try to solve technical problems that the analysts were having. There were about 6,000 analysts involved in analyzing all the data from all the countries of the world. So the biggest problem I saw was the basically ballooning information from the digital world. So the point was there was too much data, even back then in the 90s, when it wasn't anywhere near the capacity they have now to collect data. So even then they were buried. I mean, they could tend to 20 or 30,000 items every day from the day's take. They'd start through them. If they ran into something they had to report, they'd go report it and stop. And at the end of the day, they'd leave and all the rest of it wasn't looked at. So then the next day came in, the same another 20,000 or so items came down on them to look at. So they started the same process again. So even internally in NSA, they were saying we are overburdened by overload. I said, well, if you look at the data itself, you're doomed because it's just too much of it. So the metadata was the key to be able to pull out what was relevant and let the rest of it simply go by and don't let your analysts look at it. Just don't take it in.
And the haystack just keeps getting bigger,
yeah,
Bill.
Right.
I mean, give us a sense of how much data we're talking about in 2019.
Probably a couple petabytes a day, which is like a million terabytes.
Wow. I mean, several billion messages, right?
I think they're getting all the emails. So the estimate was about 90 billion a day from emails alone. I mean, we had like 12, I estimated 12 billion phone calls a day, 3 billion in the U.S. alone. All of that, and by the way, I did have evidence of them using transcription algorithms to transcribe the phone calls, which meant they could do millions and millions and millions of them. And then they use algorithms to go through the transcripts.
So they're actually doing transcriptions.
Transcription, yeah. And then they refer it to humans to transcribe. They have like 2,000, they've had since 2002 and 3, about 2,000 transcribers at Fort Gordon, Georgia that they refer them to. All these calls are indexed by number and they can call up any number and then listen to it.
Thin Thread was in direct competition to Trailblazer, of course, the program that former NSA director Michael Hayden was shopping around to private intelligence firms. Why did they go with this program, Bill, considering the encryption that was available within Thin Thread and the fact that it was far cheaper?
The basic things they removed from Thin Thread before they used it to create Stellar Wind. The selection, the filtering up front, we were selecting based on the deductive, inductive, and abductive criteria for looking at people either as known or suspected terrorists or criminals of any sort, dope smuggling, all of that. So the filtering then just let everything else go by. That's not what Cheney wanted. Cheney wanted everything. That way he had knowledge about everybody. So that filtering was removed. So everything came in. And then beyond that, if we pulled you in and you weren't known to be a terrorist and they didn't have a warrant on you, we encrypted your attributes so that nobody could tell who you were, even inside NSA. So the FBI couldn't come into the NSA database to randomly search for crimes by known persons because it wasn't equivalent, you know. It was an encrypted version. So we were protecting identities even at that point. But the final one was a real kicker for them. That was the one that analyzed the network log. And when we said that we would monitor all this and keep track of all of it and show return on investment and all that, management at NSA said, you mean Congress could come in and see all this and know what we're doing? And we said, sure, they could do that. Their answer was, you are never going to do this. So we did it secretly in the lab and incorporated it into the back end of Thin Thread. And that was another thing they got rid of because they didn't want anybody to know what they were doing. So getting rid of the filtering, they took in everything. Getting rid of the encryption meant they knew who everybody was. And getting rid of the auditing program meant that no one could find out what they're doing.
And this was a fire sale kind of opening it up to private intelligence firms to capitalize on Trailblazer, not Thin Thread, because it was far more expensive. What was the incentive, though? Because this was before the fire sale that opened up after 9/11.
The CEO of Quest, Joe Nocio, was approached in late February of 2001, about 6 months before, 7 months before 9/11, to turn over all the data on all his customers. And the person who they were from NSA, they came in from NSA to do that. So this is like the intent is there to collect data on U.S. citizens and everybody, and bulk acquisition was their motive. And the reason was because in order to do that, it's going to cost an arm and a leg.
How many other companies are we talking about here, and how much money are we talking about here?
Well, my estimate of the budget for NSA is like around $15 billion a year. And that means about 70% of that goes to the companies for contracts.
Wow, so we're talking about 75% or so that's outsourced.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And I think it's even grown. The outsourcing has grown even further since I left.
I'm sure it has. Yeah. And Watchdogs Didn't Bark, immediately after 9/11, it tells this story about you and your colleague. Your colleague was told by higher-ups at the NSA to not embarrass large companies affiliated with the intelligence failure, and that if you do your part, you'll earn
your share.
Right. And saying that they could milk the cow for 15 years. Now,
yes.
Bill, this seems like a very odd thing to say in the immediate wake of the most devastating terrorist attack on U.S. soil.
Well, you see, the focus is on getting money, and that's the reason they say those kinds of things. It's not to fix the problem. The point is to keep the problem going so they keep asking for more money.
There wasn't a moment of reckoning?
Not among greedy people, no. And that included the management of NSA.
I mean, what was your response to this when you were in the
halls? I mean, my response is testimony in their various places that they traded the security of the people of the United States and the free world for money. I mean, they still have the same problem. They haven't changed a thing. So what it means to everybody in the world is people keep dying from these attacks that they could stop. I mean, look at every attack that's happened. You know, every one is basically done by people who are already known to be bad. Well, I mean, the issue is, why aren't you focusing on them and reduce your problem and get rid of all the other people in the world?
Paint the scenario that you're talking about preventing terrorism with the 9/11 attacks. I mean, you talk about how a thin thread could have prevented this. You were looking at these centers in late December 2000.
Right, before 9/11, yeah.
So elaborate on that.
That's why I came up with the vision statement for all these companies working for NSA. They all fail to some degree on every program. That's so they can keep it going. So my originally I thought their vision statement was aim low and miss because they failed at everything. But it really is keep the problem going so the money keeps flowing.
Well, I mean, let's talk just about one center, the Yemen facility that the hijackers were communicating with. This was a heavily monitored facility from the NSA.
Yep.
What went wrong there?
Again, you know, I can't really explain it. I mean, all that data was in the NSA data as it happened. So, and this is what Alexander says. We could not tell who it was in the US. That's false. That's in the data that the analyst gets to see. That's minimization process occurs when he pulls the data. The real data is all in the collection database. And that data was there. And it was the people in San Diego.
And one of them was a perpetrator of the USS Cole bombing.
Yeah.
I mean,
and in fact, we knew those people before they, you know, I mean, we knew the entire Al-Qaeda network worldwide from about 1996 on. So if NSA didn't want to publish anything that I thought was important to get to people in any agency, I used what was called the gray phone, you know, it's the encrypted line. I would just call somebody I knew and just tell them, this is happening, you know? So I would go around it.
Why did no one do that?
See, that's the real problem. That's why a lot of people at NSA were really depressed after it, because they knew that what they did not do contributed to the failure. At the working level, you know, they couldn't understand management not wanting to report things, you know.
And at that point, Bill, I mean, after 9/11, of course, you and your colleagues had to make a choice. You had to make a choice to protect the Constitution against the government that you were serving for decades.
Yeah.
Talk about what you did. I mean, you went to your management and you described the scenario. You ended up resigning in disgust.
When I first learned about the spying on everybody in the country, U.S. country, and in Canada, and then spreading to the world, when I first learned about that was the second week in October of 2001. That's when we saw all this equipment coming in and they were moving it down the hall. So when they were setting it up and then starting to take in data, it was about the second week in October. See, they had to use our software to do it because they couldn't manage large-scale data inputs. So we had the only program that worked. So that's...
They still needed you.
Yeah, that's wrong. But they didn't want me to know because they knew I would never put up with this. You know, this is not something I would be quiet about. So, I mean, and I wasn't alone. Most of the people in the leadership in SAARC were straight-laced people. You obey the Constitution, you follow the laws, all of that, you know. And so they did this down the hall from us separately, and they were building it up. And then they started using our contractors to set up the software, take the inputs, and started running. And then when he did that, one of the contractors came to me and said, you know what they're doing down there? So they're taking in all the data on U.S. citizens. Everything that AT&T has, they're taking in. All the transmissions and calls and to, from, you know, duration, date, time, all that. So all that was being taken in. And that's a direct violation of the Fourth and, you know, First Amendments, the Constitution.
So what happened when you guys resigned? Why did you make that final decision?
First of all, three of us, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, and I were already eligible for retirement. So we retired real quickly, you know. Of course, I went directly to Diane Rourke on the House Intelligence Committee. So she managed all the write-ups of all the money requests for NSA and all the programs and everything. So I went to her and I said, you know, what they're doing here is, you know, taking in all this data. And she said, that's obviously a violation of the Constitution. And, you know, my assumption was very simple. Hayden would never have done that unless he had approval from higher up, meaning the White House. It made sense to me at the time that Cheney, being the vice president, was directing this, and with the approval of Bush. And Bush said, Cheney, you take over. Yeah, but the problem is he took a lot of people with him, and now he took a lot of countries with him now. So they're all doing this. And it's all fundamentally violating their constitutional human rights issues.
We've gone so far with the bulk acquisition, it seems impossible to start to roll it back.
Actually, that's not true.
Yeah?
You unfund them. When you cut their budget, they can't do it.
Yeah, but isn't there kind of an intelligence security complex that's, you know, you can argue is just kind of operating on its own?
I call it the Praetorian Guard. You know, those who want to manage who is president or leader and who and what they do. They can control what they do by simply modifying, selecting only certain information and making it available to them. You know, it kind of gives them the ideas. What would give the president the idea of doing this? Mm-hmm. So you select the data that would influence him in making a decision to do that.
In 2007, Bill, the FBI raided your home alongside colleague Kurt Wiebe. What was that experience like for you guys, and were you surprised by the aggressiveness of the response?
Yeah, well, you know, I was in the shower at the time, and they broke in and pushed my son out of the way at gunpoint. Came up and pointed guns at my wife. They came in the shower and pointed guns at me, and I sat there and, you know, why am I a threat, you know? So the point was, and I'm pretty sure that Attorney General Gonzalez sent them there to keep us quiet because he had just testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about the president's terrorist surveillance program, where he only talked about the tapping of phones when someone in the U.S. is talking to a foreigner. That was the part they talked about. They didn't talk about any of the rest of it, which was total bulk acquisition of everything that every U.S. citizen does. On the internet, on the phone network, and on in financial transactions, anything in financial transactions, credit card use, everything. So all of that they didn't talk about, and they were afraid. They knew we had experience of going to committees in the Congress. They didn't want that to happen, and so Gonzalez said, you better hit them now, and so they did.
So, you know, they were desperate.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they wanted to keep this out of court, no public exposure on the surveillance program, so concoct something about it. And they were doing that to us too, and they tried three separate times to indict us, right? So at the same time, I was accumulating evidence of malicious prosecution on the part of the justice and also the FBI. When it came time to do that, I, you know, got the information to them that I was preparing to charge them with malicious prosecution when they took us to court for this fabricated conspiracy charge they were manufacturing.
So the NSA says that, of course, none of this data that you're talking about is used maliciously against American citizens. Talk about why that's not true, and also the parallel construction, kind of retroactive framing of, you know, how you can use this.
They're speaking when they say that. They're speaking for analysts in NSA. That's the only people they're speaking for. But they don't tell you that they left taps in for CIA and FBI and DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And they also didn't tell anybody that the Five Eyes, GCHQ and Britain, you know, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders also had direct access to that database. This is the collection of bulk acquisition of data all piled into the, I assume it's all basically in the Utah 1 million square foot storage facility. And they allow them direct access in to interrogate it, and that's all done without any oversight whatsoever. And, you know, then they used it against Jim Risen, Jim Rosen, the Associated Press, and...
So they have already used this data to spy on activist groups and whistleblowers
reporters.
And groups like Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, right, and reporters of all sorts.
So they're already using it, and
yes.
And the DEA has access, all these other agencies have access, and also what you and Snowden have frequently talked about, which is the retroactive prosecutorial aspect
right,
of this.
Right, that's the next step. Once you've got the data and the access to it, you can search target people, for example, if you get a tip from the streets, you know, somebody's a dope dealer, you go into this data and look at everything that person's doing, you know, assemble evidence for prosecution, and you could say, go arrest these people. So that's the way they originally arrest people. Then when it comes to going to a criminal court, they actually do the parallel construction, which means they use standard policing techniques to look for data that will implicate them in a crime. And it helps that they know where the data is, so.
But they pretend that it's not from the NSA that they acquired it from.
Right, they substitute that for the NSA data in a court of law and say, here's the evidence that we use to prosecute them or to arrest them. You know, it's basic perjury, okay? So, and this is policy of the Department of Justice of the United States. And they used the two-hop principle that Obama thought was really the way to do it. We told him it wasn't. You needed to add some restrictions because it meant that, like, if I called Google, that's one hop. Or if I, you know, got an email with Google, that's one hop. The next hop is Google out. That's to 1.5 billion people a day, roughly. So within a few days, you have virtually everybody in the network on. So that means you can spy on anybody. So NSA was happy with that. Once NSA is happy, you know there's something wrong, right? It's real simple.
Bill, we didn't hear much about Vault 7 in the WikiLeaks revelation about
nobody
that.
Wants
and
to talk about
the
that.
CIA spying apparatus that potentially more unaccountable than the NSA. I mean, talk about how far reaching
that
goes.
Actually, I think what they had in Vault 7 was a contribution from NSA and GCHQ and the other Five Eyes combined. Here's all our attacks. See what you can do with it. And they may have developed some of their own by actually capturing them from foreign countries. The ability, once you acquire it, to manipulate it, change it, and make it look like someone else is doing a hack or something like that. It was a set of programs that would allow them to make it look like the Russians did it or the Chinese.
Right.
Or you know, I mean, all those kinds of things are possible too. I mean, they could even go in and attack your computer, look into your files and change and modify what you have there. So they could make it look like you're guilty of any crime.
Before Snowden's revelations, before 9/11, Americans had a different mentality where we had the kind of memory of the Stasi, Nazi Germany, where you can ask people, oh God, I'd never support something like that, right? Why this kind of mainstream complacency and kind of the mantra now where I have nothing to hide, so why should I have anything to fear?
A great quote from Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister for Hitler. You know, so, I mean, those are great quotes. I mean, that's exactly how totalitarian states operate. That's the point. This is a totalitarian-based slide. This is where we're going. You know, I think they've done it by basically generating fear in the population. The fear that something's going to happen unless they do this. When in fact, I mean, we knew that was a fraud from the beginning. You don't have to give up any privacy to have security.
Let's move on to the allegations of Russian hacking into Podesta's email account in the DNC. Can you first go over the evidence that Mueller claims to have to prove that it's Russia?
Well, you see, I really don't, I don't know of any evidence that Mueller has because he never made it public. So. The only evidence I have is what's made public. And from that, it went into the Rosenstein indictment, you know, the Gusser 2 and DC leaks data. And they talked about that as the evidence for the indictments and so on. You know, they claimed that the Gusser 2 was a Russian. But the timestamps that we have on the programming inside the data that was published by Gusser 2 shows a timestamps that are consistently inside the United States. But that's not the real issue. The real issue was with the data itself and how quickly it was downloaded. It was incompatible with a transfer across the net to anywhere. over any distance. If it went beyond the high-speed line that you had dedicated to you, then it's slowed down.
And explain that in layman's terms, why you think this was an inside leak as opposed to a hack.
Okay, well, the fastest download speed we had was a 49.1 megabyte rate, which meant that the hacker was taking the data out at that rate across the network, wherever they were. You know, they could be local, they could be anywhere. So we said, okay, well, what is the capacity of the lines going across to Europe? And at that point, everything failed, right? You couldn't get it across that fast. But you could do a thumb drive or something local. Some of our people disagreed with that. They said they thought it could. So we said, okay, we're going to try it. So, you know, got hacker friends in Europe trying to, and a friend in the U.S. to put up a gigabyte of data and say, here, try to pull it across, see how fast you can get it. And the fastest they could get was from a data center in New Jersey to the U.K. in London. And that was 12.0 megabytes per second, less than one-fourth the necessary capacity to transmit the data alone.
But what about the timestamps? Do you think that Russia could have been throwing off analysts by planting false timestamps?
Well, first of all, you have to understand the massive surveillance that's involved. Everything is captured, so by NSA. So NSA should have some of that evidence somewhere, and they have failed to come forward. Even in the ICA, the intelligence community assessment that Russia hacked it, you know, NSA had moderate confidence.
Right. What does that mean?
That means we have no evidence.
Because the other intelligence agencies said they had confidence, but the NSA said they had moderate confidence.
But you see, they aren't relevant. When it comes to communication, NSA is the only one that matters. The rest of them don't.
And did they explain what the moderate confidence that they had meant?
No. I mean, to me, that's language for I have no evidence.
So look, I wanted to get this out of the way because it's always interested me. Because you claim that British diplomat Craig Murray corroborates this, that he claims that he handed over a drive to someone.
He talked to somebody who was involved in transferring the data, yeah.
So he himself talked to someone.
But even from the forensic evidence based on the WikiLeaks exposure of data that they published, there were multiple ways that they got it.
And who else has corroborated your findings?
A number of technical people in the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity and others around the world, by the way.
Mm-hmm. You're not hesitant to call people in the U.S. government criminals, co-conspirators. Are there any enforcement bodies that are still doing their job and following the Constitution at this point?
Actually, it's getting hard to find them. Even the Rutherford Institute, looking at the application of law around the world, local and state people, are seeing, you know, the idea that they have scrapped the Fourth Amendment in terms of their arresting and searching people and things like that.
What about the CIA? Should that agency be abolished?
Actually, I think they do perform a function that's meaningful to keep. But the rest of it, sure. There's a big chunk of it that should be eliminated. So for NSA also.
Yeah.
You know, I think we can cut the intelligence budget, which is probably over $100 billion a year, you know, and they're really trying to defend us, but have failed every time an attack occurs.
As you mentioned, there's barely anyone in Congress that has a different view on U.S. foreign policy, on curbing the surveillance state, curbing the police state. What is going on here? Why is no one able to see what we're seeing, Bill?
Well, because we're not members of the military intelligence complex or the shadow government. We're not members of that. So, you know, everybody in that environment is kind of, they're in their own bubble, okay?
Everyone in Congress?
A good many of them, yeah. You must, at all costs, protect the program. Because if you don't, we lose power control and eventually money.
So I know that you said you don't link up to wireless networks and, you know, surveillance technology, but what do you say to the audience who just feels completely disillusioned at this point, saying, look, we have to incorporate some of our lives online? What are they supposed to do?
It's a matter of don't put anything out there that you don't want someone else to read.
But even speak at this point.
That too. Don't say anything you don't want anybody else to hear.
That's a pretty stark reality, isn't it?
Now, I say everything because I want them to hear. Okay? Because I want them to know what I'm going to do in court.
Yeah, but what about people who want to protect their privacy?
Then you invent your own encryption and don't pass it through NIST because then they will have it. So you don't do that. You don't use anything publicly because they already got that.
And the encryption methodologies that are available now were the NSA was involved in constructing themselves.
Well, they also know the algorithms, all of them. They have the software for it, because it has to run through NIST to do testing. They do the testing, and then they approve it for public use. So I say, hey, if you're talking to your little community, make your own encryption. You don't care. You're not doing this publicly. We're just doing it among ourselves. So that would cause them a real problem.